Hello, patrons. To use a soccer analogy, I kept the Content Wednesday ball up for 12 weeks with only one episode postponed till a Friday. But I think it's now evident to all of us that my experiment with supercalifragilisticexpialidocious has not worked quite as well as I hoped it would. Some people might be able to write their novels quickly, some people might be able to record their novels quickly, but I, I'm afraid, am not one of them. It would be different if Underground was a completed novel and this podcast was simply a case of me going back to the beginning of the finished book and reading it aloud. But as you know, this book isn't written to its completion. It's being written for podcast, chapter by chapter, and so every chapter goes to podcast before the next chapter is written. Of course, I suppose I could stop all content completely and write the book to its completion for a year and then begin the podcast, but I don't think anybody would particularly like that. Maybe the Wednesdays could have worked better if the idea had been restricted only to getting an episode of Dracula out, but the way I set things up was alternative Dracula, Underwood and Flinch Dracula, and consequently I found myself rushing Underwood and Flinch, rushing the writing, rushing the recordings, and if Underwood and Flinch wasn't ready as Wednesday loomed, then rushing recordings of Dracula or Lovecraft to try to fill the hole. Content is one thing, but rushed content, especially if it's Underwood and Flinch Underground, is something nobody wants, as some of your recent comments illustrate. Mike W. says, "Would much rather you take the time and do it well than rush a partial episode out for some arbitrary self-imposed deadline." David Melton says, "I like the idea of Content Wednesday, but I wonder if you put undue pressure on yourself. I'd be happy with content once every 10 to 14 days, rather that than you risk compromising on creativity or quality to meet a 7-day deadline." Stephen Morris says, "I'd rather wait as long as it takes than have you feel you have to get things done by a certain day." On the Call of Cthulhu episode that I put out, David Nicol comments, "It comes across as being very rushed. To me, it doesn't sound as nuanced as your usual readings. It was, to me, a bit flat. Whilst I appreciate the discipline of getting something out every week, I personally would rather have waited." And finally, Tim Renshaw says, "If you can't meet a deadline, then don't have them. I enjoy the content. I don't enjoy looking forward to promised content and it not being there." Well, thank you all for those comments. Some were cheering, some smarted a little bit, but they're all fair. And me reading your comments out isn't just about me reading the ones that ring my bell, as it were. So, in conclusion, let's just remove that deadline. Let's scratch out the Wednesday from the phrase Content Wednesday and just go back to having content as and when it's ready for your ears to enjoy. Which sounds like this.
And now, exclusive to Patreon, it's...
Hi, this is A Real Girl, the director of Doom at ScottSigler.com, and you are listening to Underwood and Flinch, Underground, Episode 29.
Hello, patrons, and thank you, A, for that intro. I recorded that live on my little iPod thingy on a recent excursion up to Dublin for Scott Sigler's event in a pub, which was nice. But anyway, welcome back to Underwood and Flinch Underground, where the word count is now 132,949 words and rising. To put that into perspective, using some famous books, To Kill a Mockingbird has 100,388 words. Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban has 106,821 words. And Schindler's List has 134,462 words. So, our story, Underwood and Flinch Underground, is now a bona fide big novel. And the third act hasn't even started yet. And all of it, every last one of those 132,949 words, is thanks to you, because you support the creation of them here on Patreon. Yes, yes, huzzah, huzzah, and thanks everyone. In a moment, I'll be putting some more of those words into your ears. But first, a very necessary...
flashback!
Yes, you may recall that Detective Inspector Claire Redmond was lured to a hotel in Whitechapel, London, by a woman called Jessie Collins, who claimed to be a friend of the first victim of the London vampire. Claire went to meet her, but it wasn't any Jesse Collins at all. It was Lydia Flinch. Claire then woke up in the hotel the next morning with no real memory of the night before and was unknowingly now working as a spy for Lydia. She met with Chief Detective Inspector Guy Valentine and tried to find out what he knew about the case, but it all turned sour and ended up with Claire and Valentine being called to the office of Chief Superintendent Charles Coleridge. At the meeting that followed, Coleridge explained to her that her suspicions about the existence of the Occult Crimes Unit were, in fact, correct, that he and Valentine were in it, and that they were treating the London vampire investigation as a real vampire incident. But Coleridge is a vampire hunter of long standing, and he recognised the symptoms of Claire's having been fascinated by a vampire, and he informed her that he had the power to hypnotise her to such a degree that he would be able to undo the fascination and help her remember what had happened to her at the hotel. Meanwhile, David Flinch spotted Damo on a London street and chased him down into Holborn Underground Station, unknowingly pursued himself by both the police and an operative of the sect. The policeman, who was OCU, tried to arrest David, but the sect guy zapped him with a taser. He wanted David to come with him, but could give no assurances as to Damo's well-being once the sect had caught up with him. Unhappy with that, David zapped the sect guy with a taser and ran off after Damo into an underground train tunnel. Phew! Well, we'll get back to David later on, but we begin this episode with DCI Claire Redmond, and things are not quite what they seem. Underwood and Flinch, Underground. A novel written and performed for podcast by Mike Bennett. This podcast is intended for an adult audience. Episode 29. Claire Redmond was back at the King Edward Hotel in Whitechapel. She was lying on the bed, her back against pillows propped up against the headboard. In her hand was a glass of chilled white wine. It was a second glass. She didn't want to drink it, but...
"Be sure and drink your wine now, Claire," Lydia called from the ensuite bathroom. "What you have there is the last of it now, because I've poured the rest down the loo."
She came back into the room, the now empty bottle between her gloved fingers. On seeing Claire taking slow sips of the wine, she said,
"Oh, for God's sake, come on, Redmond. Down in one. There's a good girl."
Claire drank the wine down in one, as ordered. Then she held the empty glass, unsure what to do with it. Lydia sat down on the bed beside her. She put the bottle on the nightstand and gestured for Claire to do the same with the glass.
"Just put it there, will you?"
Claire did as she was told. "That's it. So," Lydia looked at her watch.
"Oh, shit, we're cutting it a bit fine, Cynthia. I'm meeting James in less than half an hour."
"Well, I'm ready any time you are, darling," said Cynthia, who sat on a chair against the far wall, her attention divided between Redmond and her phone, into which she was carefully thumbing a text message.
"All right, we're going to leave you now, Claire. But remember, you are my eyes and ears. Find out everything your Inspector Valentine knows about the London vampire case. Do whatever it takes. And if that means shagging him, then you'll do so with vim and gusto. Do you understand?"
"Yes."
"Good. But everything else that's happened to you tonight, you'll forget, except for the version of events that I gave you earlier. All right?"
"Yes." Lydia smiled, clearly delighted. She reached out and touched Claire on the chin, tilting her head to reveal where she had bitten her neck a short while ago. The puncture wounds had already closed and were now just two red marks on the skin with a little blood around the edges. Lydia leaned in and licked the blood away, and Claire shivered with pleasure beneath her.
"I know, sweetie," said Lydia. "I'd love to stay and spend some more time together, but I really do have to go. I have your phone number, so I'll call you tomorrow night and you can give me all the latest on the case. Until then," she gave Claire a little peck on the cheek, "ciao."
Claire watched as Lydia went to the mirror and checked her makeup, reapplying the lipstick she'd removed before biting Claire, and then asking Cynthia how she looked. Happy with her appearance, she and Cynthia then stepped outside. Lydia hung the Do Not Disturb notice on the door handle, turned out the light, and before closing the door said, "Sleep now, Claire. Sleep." Then all was darkness.
"What was the next thing you remember?"
said Detective Chief Superintendent Coleridge from somewhere beyond the room.
"Waking up the next morning."
"They didn't return again after they'd left?"
"No."
"Move forwards then to the next morning, the time when you woke up."
The darkness gave way to light, the curtained windows glowing with the sunlight. She could hear traffic and voices on the street outside.
"Are you alone?" asked Coleridge.
"Yes."
Then a mobile phone began to ring, loud, close, like it was in the room with her. Now she could hear Valentine speaking, nearby but indistinct. She found she wasn't listening to what he was saying, had no interest. He was like someone speaking on a radio in the background. Now Coleridge was speaking, but not to her. And again, she had no interest. Not until he spoke to her directly, addressing her by name.
"Claire, I'm going to count down now from 5 to 1, and when I get to 1, you will awake, and you will remember everything. 5, 4, returning to us now. 3, you are safe and there's nothing to fear. 2, opening your eyes. And 1.
Claire's eyes fluttered open. She was in Coleridge's office. He was smiling at her from where he sat opposite at his desk.
"Welcome back, Claire. Are you okay?"
Claire's hand went to the side of her neck like she had just felt the sting of a wasp.
"Oh my God, she fed on me."
"Yes," said Coleridge calmly, "but you've nothing to be afraid of. You're free of her now."
"But she bit me. Her bite. Am I going to become one of them? Like her?"
She felt cool tears on her cheeks and wiped them away.
"No," said Coleridge, turning off the voice recorder on his desk. "The whole transformation business is a bit more complicated than that, thank heaven. Were it not, I imagine we as a species would have been wiped out long ago."
Valentine stood up.
"Well, I'd better get going, sir."
"What?"
said Claire.
"Why? Where are you going?"
As soon as the words were out, she regretted them. She sounded concerned, worried for him. When she'd been fascinated, Lydia had asked her if she'd fancied him. Her answer had come straight from her unconscious mind, a simple, pragmatic yes. She'd just recounted that detail, along with everything else, as she relived it, and Valentine had taken it all down on the notepad that he now tossed onto Coleridge's desk.
"I mean, has something happened, sir?"
"I got a call," he said, crossing to the door. "A couple of our guys have been involved in an incident at Holborn Station. I'll leave it to the Chief Super to fill you in." He paused on opening the door to turn back to Claire. "But, well done, Redmond. What you've given us here today is bloody amazing. Really, thank you."
He gave her an approving nod, then said to Coleridge,
"And for what it's worth, sir, I'd like to remove my earlier objection to Inspector Redmond joining the unit.
Thank you, Valentine," Coleridge interrupted. "Your opinion is noted. Now, get going." Once Valentine had gone, he turned back to Claire. She was stroking and probing at a spot on her neck. She looked worried. He got up and came to her side.
"Here, let me see."
Claire lowered her hand, and he smoothed her hair away from her neck. There were 2 very faint pink marks on the skin.
"Yes, 2 puncture wounds, all right. Barely visible now. No one would have noticed it, and I'd say it'll be gone completely in a couple of hours."
"Should I see a doctor?"
"Oh, I don't think that'll be necessary."
Coleridge walked back to his chair and sat down.
"How much time have you spent in daylight today?"
"Sorry?"
"Ultraviolet radiation, Claire. Exposure to it kills the vampire's infection in your blood."
Claire thought for a moment.
"I'm not sure. Walking from one place to another, maybe an hour? And I sat at the window in the restaurant."
"Well, it sounds to me like you've had more than enough to kill it off."
But what if I haven't? What if it's still there?
Well, you could go to a tanning salon, he smiled. But really, it's not necessary. Trust me, it's dead. Claire still looked worried.
How does it work, then, this infection? How does it turn you into a vampire?
Well, if this Lydia, a.k.a. Jessie Collins, had wanted to turn you into a vampire, she would have made you drink her blood straight after biting you. It's the oral ingestion of her blood that completes the circuit of infection. But since you only received the bite, you're in no danger. The human immune system destroys the infection in around 48 hours, and exposure to sunlight hastens the process. Believe me, Claire, you are fine.
Perhaps, but now that I know, now that I remember...
She closed her eyes and a fresh tear spilled down her cheek.
I feel violated.
I'm sorry, Claire. Retrieving the memory of vampire encounters, especially when they involve an attack like this, I'm afraid they're something of a blessing and a curse.
It's all right, sir. I wouldn't have had it any other way. My God, though, to think I was working for her, serving her like a slave. She could have told me to do anything, and I...
You would have done it. It wouldn't have mattered who you were. Once a person's been deeply fascinated like that, they'll obey their master without question.
I would have killed?
Oh, yes, if that was her instruction.
Oh, Jesus.
Claire put a hand to her mouth.
I feel sick.
Coleridge sprang from his chair and grabbed his litter bin. He ran around to Claire and thrust it at her, but she raised a hand to stop him.
It's okay, she said with a faint smile. It's passing.
Coleridge said nothing, but inwardly sighed with relief to know his office wouldn't be smelling of vomit for weeks to come. He put his bin back down on the floor and turned to face her. Okay, then. If you're feeling up to it, I'd like to go over what you've just told us.
Yes, of course. I'm all right.
Would you like a coffee? Maybe something stronger? He tapped the lid of the bottle of whiskey on his desk.
No, but maybe some water.
Water, yes. Coleridge went over to a filing cabinet, on top of which was a jug of water and three glasses. He poured Claire a glass and handed it to her. Then he picked up the notepad on which Valentine had been jotting down notes of Claire's account of what had happened. Okay, he said, sitting down. So, our vampire's name is Lydia. You say she and her accomplice, Cynthia, started using their real name shortly after she fascinated you.
Yes. Lydia felt there was no need to go on with the aliases once I was in her power.
No doubt she thought you were hers for good. Interesting. That's something of a schoolboy error on her part. Tell me, do you remember their faces well enough to give us facial composites?
Yes, definitely. I remember them both vividly.
Good. Okay, so the first thing Lydia asked you about then was the church murder. Is that right?
Yes. She was specifically interested in that. I think because she was responsible for the other one, the girl in the skip. She only mentioned that later, and when she did, it was only to find out what, if any, evidence we had.
Okay, well, we'll come to that in a minute. But when she asked you about the church murder, can you tell me again what you told her?
Yes. She got straight to the point. She wanted to know if it was the work of a vampire. I told her I thought it was, and she asked me why. I told her about the bite on the victim's neck. The news seemed to disturb her, even though she must have expected it to a degree. She and Cynthia then started talking about who it could be. There was a name they mentioned. I can't seem to remember. When she wasn't addressing me directly, it was like I was kind of turned off. Their voices were there, though in the background. And there was a name. Anderson? No, it ended in something like good or would.
Coleridge sat forward, his face suddenly charged with interest. Underwood?
Yes, that was it. They were discussing whether or not it could have been someone called Underwood.
I see, said Coleridge thoughtfully as he scribbled a note on the pad.
Does that name mean anything to you?
No, just an educated guess. Coleridge finished writing and returned his full attention to Claire. Did you hear them say anything about this Underwood?
No, sir, it wasn't clear. There were other names, too. James.
Coleridge scribbled down a note. Yes. Anything specific about him?
Lydia was going to meet him. She mentioned it a couple of times. Reliving it just now, I felt it was very important to her.
Any idea what kind of meeting? Romantic? Business?
No.
Claire watched Coleridge draw a question mark beside his note about James. Pity. Go on.
So, when they'd finished talking, Lydia came back and wanted to know what my next moves would be. That was when I told her I was no longer on the case. That really annoyed her. She turned back to Cynthia and started having a go at her for saying I was the one in charge. They argued, but again, it was like I was unplugged from it all. I know Cynthia said that she'd seen me on TV that day, but that's all I can remember.
Yes, as we thought. Cynthia must have seen an early news bulletin, but not the later ones. If she had, she would have seen my statement, and they almost certainly would have come after me instead.
Well, they still might, sir.
When she asked who'd taken over the case, I told her it was you who'd replaced me with Valentine. Did you tell her any of your suspicions about our involvement with the OCU?
No, I only answered her direct questions, and she didn't ask about that.
Did you mention the OCU at all?
No, sir.
Coleridge considered a moment, then said, What about something called the Malleus?
The what?
The Malleus. Claire shook her head.
No.
Coleridge nodded thoughtfully.
Then possibly she doesn't know about us.
Us being the OCU or this Malleus? Both. The Malleus is, or was, an international order dedicated to wiping vampires from the face of the earth. The OCU came about in the late Victorian age as a result of there being a number of high-ranking police officials in the London Order. Older vampires generally tend to be aware of the Malleus and the OCU, which makes me wonder if Lydia isn't aware of them, then maybe she isn't an older vampire after all.
So you think she could be as much of a newborn vampire as the one who committed the church murders?
Possibly, yes. And if so, maybe both of these newborn vampires were created by the same older vampire.
But wouldn't that older vampire have been more, I don't know, more cautious about letting two newborn vampires go off on such a killing spree?
Typically, yes, Coleridge nodded, which is what makes this all the more intriguing. Either their creator let them loose on the world in this unprepared state because he wanted to bring the attention of the police and the world's media upon his kind and quite probably himself, or these newborns simply turned on their maker before he could educate them.
Do vampires do that? Kill their makers?
Well, certainly not typical behaviour. Vampires usually only make other vampires when they wish to take a mate. You know, love, sex, and that sort of thing. Maybe one of these newborns, or both, were made for that purpose.
A love triangle? Well, they aren't known for being happy ever after.
No, indeed.
But, sir, Lydia didn't seem to know who the other vampire was, or what they'd done at the church.
Yes. It's a pity you couldn't make out what she and Cynthia were saying when they weren't talking to you. We could try to explore it in another hypnosis session, but performing something of that depth is frankly beyond my abilities. We'd need to enlist a skilled psychiatric professional.
Do you know someone?
Coleridge thought for a moment. I've known people in the past, but I doubt any of them are still practicing. Haven't needed anything like this for a damn long time. Still, I'm sure I can arrange something. Anyway, let's return to your encounter with Lydia. So, once she knew that you weren't heading up the investigation, she told you to move on Valentine to find out what he knew.
Yes, and when I said I couldn't do that because the case was nothing to do with me anymore, she said I should use my feminine charm.
Coleridge checked the notes. Or shag him with vim and gusto, as she later put it.
Yes.
Well, at least it didn't come to that, eh? Said Coleridge with a smile. Claire lowered her head and covered her eyes with her hand. Coleridge cursed himself for his insensitivity. Damn, I'm sorry, Claire. I didn't mean to make light of the situation.
It's okay, sir. It's just, Jesus, the things that she could have made me do, and now knowing that I would have done them, it's just awful.
Then Claire looked up, her eyes suddenly full of fear.
Oh, my God, she's going to phone me. When she calls me...
Don't worry, Claire, you're safe.
No, she's going to call me. She has a trigger word, and when she says it, I'll tell her everything.
Yes, I know that's what she said, but I've undone all that.
What was the word again? Beltane?
He checked the notes. No, Beltran. Is that right?
Yes. I don't know what it means. Do you?
No, but we'll look into it. The important thing is that when she does call, you've got nothing to fear, okay? You are completely removed from her power, and nothing she says to you over the phone will change that. However, she doesn't need to know that.
What?
When she calls you, you will do everything she says exactly as if you were still under her fascination. But of course, you won't be.
Okay, but what am I going to say to her?
Something that will make her come and pay you a second visit.
I had a bad feeling you were going to say that, sir.
No doubt, but I think you'll agree that it's an opportunity we can't ignore.
So what do you have in mind?
Coleridge considered a moment, then said, Valentine is the key. Lydia knows he's running the show. She's got you spying on him, trying to prise information out of his head and feed it back to her. However, I suspect that if she were given another opportunity to have the actual head of the London vampire investigation under her spell, she'd grab it with both hands. Tell me, did you tell her where you live?
No. All she asked for was my phone number.
You're sure?
Absolutely.
Good. So, you tell her you've tried to get information from Valentine on a professional level, but it didn't work. So, as she suggested, you've used your feminine charms on him and invited him for a romantic dinner at your place. However, when the time comes, it won't be your place. It'll be a flat owned by the Met, and we'll be waiting for her.
So I'd tell her about the date, the time and place, and she'd come round while he was there to fascinate him. That's the trap.
Yes.
But what if she doesn't? What if she says, fine, enjoy the date, pump him for information, and I'll call you tomorrow?
Well, if she does, then we'll have to come up with some false case information for you to have extracted on the date, which you can then pass on when she calls again. Whatever that information is will also be part of a trap to ensnare her. But we'll need time to put that plan together, and she could call at any minute. We need something we can use right now, and I can get this romantic date of yours organized in 30 minutes.
All right, but it's dark outside now. What if she calls before you're ready? What if she wants to know where I am right now?
Tell her. That's what you do if you were in her power.
And if she wants me to go somewhere to meet her?
Then you go, with me and a number of other officers in close pursuit. Don't worry, Claire, you're going to have better protection than the Queen until we catch this monster. We look after our own here at the OCU.
Claire frowned. Our own? But, sir, I'm not OCU.
I'm assuming you still want to be, though, unless that was Lydia influencing you to say that you were keen on joining us.
Oh, no, sir, that was me. And yes, I still want to, very much.
Good. I promised your late father I'd keep you safe from these monsters, Claire. And until now, that's meant concealing both them and the unit from you. I hope he'd understand that now, since they've found you anyway, the surest way of keeping you safe from them is by equipping you with the knowledge and the means to fight them yourself. He extended his hand across the table to her. Welcome to the Occult Crimes Unit, Inspector Redmond. And may God defend you. David ran between the rails that shone like parallel streams of silver in the lights from the train behind him. They melted into darkness a short distance ahead. But in that distance he was able to see how the tunnel curved gradually around to the left. He ran on,
the shouts and cries of people on the platform growing fainter beneath the sound of his feet crunching on sleeper stones. The light grew fainter too, and soon he was in near total darkness. There was a red signal light up ahead. He walked towards it, and as his eyes adjusted to the dark, it provided him with enough light to see the tracks. When he reached the light, he stopped. "Damo!" he called. "Listen, if you're here, please talk to me. I don't know how long it's going to be before they come after me, and well, there's no way I can go any further than this without stumbling onto a live rail." He listened for a response, but none came. "Are you there? Look, I know what's happened to you. I know what you are. But I'm not the only one. Underwood's people, the sect, they told me they wanted to help you, and I don't know, maybe they do, but that business back there in the station, one of their guys was following me. You spotted him, but I had no idea he was there, or the cop for that matter. But the sect guy, Glover, he said something and, well, I guess I don't know if I can trust him after all. Shit, man, he drugged me and held me captive, so what the fuck am I talking about? No, I don't trust them, and nor should you. Glover said something about someone that was going to judge you for what you'd done. What that is, the London murders, the murder of my girlfriend, I don't know. I just... Jesus, Damo, I'm sorry, man. I'm so fucking sorry for what's happened to you. If I could go back in time and have it happen to me instead of you, I would." He listened for a reply, but the only sound was the eerie, hollow sigh of the breeze moving through the tunnel. "Are you even here? Am I just talking to myself?" Damo's voice came from out of the darkness. "What do you mean, the murder of your girlfriend?" David looked to where he thought the voice was coming from, searching the dark for a sign of his friend. "Lisa, my girlfriend, she was attacked by a vampire. They left her tied to a chair to wait for me. They wanted me to be her first meal. And you think that was me? To be honest, I don't know. You've certainly got good reason to want to hurt me. I mean, everything that's happened to you is because you saved me from Lydia. I thought it was Underwood at first, but he's dead."
"Dead?"
The sound of stones crunching underfoot as Damo came a few steps closer.
"Underwood?"
"Yeah, he was destroyed, burnt up by the sun on the roof of La Fantasia. He took Lydia with him." A few footsteps more, and Damo emerged into the pool of red light.
"How do you know? Were you there?"
"No, but I went up there straight after him. His ashes, hers, they were all around, along with shoes, pieces of burnt clothing, his watch."
"But you didn't actually see them die?"
"No, but he's dead. I mean, there was no way he could have survived that."
"So then why is his stuff coming here?"
"You know about that?"
"Jesus, why I came here? I had a vague hope he could help me, him or you, but I guess that was as daft as it sounds."
"It's not daft, Damo. It was a reasonable idea."
"Yeah, but a wrong one all the same, right, Dave?"
Reluctantly, David nodded.
"Yeah." "So you still haven't said why Underwood's stuff is coming here?"
"Well, it's in his will, apparently. I don't know, that's what they told me anyway."
"Who told you? The sect?"
"Yeah."
"The people you just said you don't trust."
"Look, I know, I..."
"Shit,"
David clasped his head.
"I don't know what to believe anymore. All I know for sure is that Lisa is dead and you and I are alive. Well, I hate to be splitting hairs with you, Dave, but I don't think I really fit that category anymore."
"So, it's true then? You really are?"
"Yeah, I really am."
"Oh, shit, I am so sorry."
"Ah, don't worry about it. I'm sorry about your girlfriend. And for the record, no, it wasn't me that did that to her."
On seeing the relief on David's face, he added,
"But before you go thinking I'm some vampire in a white hat and shining armour, I did kill my own girlfriend and two other people, including that priest in the papers."
"But you didn't kill the girl in the skip?"
"No, that was nothing to do with me. I thought Underwood did the other one. But now you see he's dead."
"Yeah. The sect think that the other vampire's like you, someone infected in Spain during Underwood's recent activity.
but they also told me that there's a whole load of other vampires out there from what they call other bloodlines, which basically means vampires who aren't connected to Underwood by blood. They say that these other bloodlines and Underwood's bloodline have some kind of code, whereby they don't kill each other, or people like my family, the guardians that serve vampires. But I don't know. Maybe there's a vampire out there with a grievance against my family that doesn't give a shit about the code, and now that Underwood's gone, they're out to settle scores, which is why they attacked Lisa. But the sect don't buy that. No, they said no one would break the code. It's like a law for them. Well, you want to know what I think? Yeah, of course. I think they're right. If another vampire had a beef with Hugh Flinches, he could have wiped out the lot of yous any time over the last 50 years while Underwood's been in Spain hibernating. Shit, they could have fucking put a match to Underwood's house and burned him alive and all. But they didn't, did they? So maybe this code thing is as big a deal as they say it is. So then, who does that leave? I don't know. You tell me. Well, it's got to be someone else from Spain, hasn't it? Maybe someone who survived La Fantasia. How many people did Underwood get his teeth into there? No, Damo, everybody else died. The Russians and the Serbs, for sure. Lydia and Underwood, they died on the roof. Underwood killed Miguel. And you and I, well, let's just say we're accounted for. Did you see Miguel die? Well, kind of, yeah. Kind of. In other words, no. So that makes three presumed dead, but non-confirmed. Underwood, Lydia, and Miguel. Have you checked hospital records? No. Jesus, Lydia and Underwood were just ashes, and Miguel would have been a John Doe in a body bag. So him and me would have that in common, wouldn't we? And look how I turned out. Listen, Dave, you gotta go online and check hospital records. I don't know the name of the hospital I was taken to, but whichever one it was, I'll bet you that that's where they took Miguel and all. Check for the John Doe's bought in on the night of the shooting, and when you find them, you'll see that at least one of them, me, went missing. Actually, see if there's any reports of murdered hospital employee. That was my first killing, I'm afraid. But it'll narrow it down for you. And when you find that hospital, I'll bet you any money you like that another John Doe went walkabout and all.
Miguel?
Yeah. But don't limit your suspicions to him. He wasn't the only one you didn't see die that night.
You still think it could be Underwood?
Look, put it this way, Dave. Why does a dead man need to move house? And don't tell me it's in his will.
Well, the sect's lawyers, they say that sometimes he does this. He dies and he comes back again years later.
Oh, I'll bet he does. No, I know what you're thinking. I thought that as well, but what about Lydia? Lydia? No. Why the fuck not? Because she can't have. I saw the ashes, Damo.
A beam of light raked through the darkness behind David. Damo jumped aside with preternatural speed and slid into an alcove in the wall of the tunnel. David turned back to see the silhouettes of four men with headlights on, climbing down onto the tracks. Two of them carried flashlights, the beams of which revealed that the other two carried compact submachine guns.
Well, they look like they mean business, Dave. I reckon they think you're packing. Listen, do me a favour, will you? They know you're in here, but not me. Let's keep it that way, eh?
David nodded.
Sure, but what will you do? Don't worry about me. I'll be all right. I've got a system now, so it won't be killing anybody else.
There was no time to ask what that system might be.
Okay, but how are we going to meet again?
Probably best if we don't, things being what they are.
Good luck, Dave. And remember, if you didn't see them die, don't be surprised if they turn up and bite you on the arse.
It wasn't funny. It was terrifying. But David grinned all the same. Then he raised his hands above his head and started toward the flashlight beam swinging back and forth ahead of him. When they shouted at him to halt and get down, he complied, listening, as he did, to the sound of Damo's fast-retreating footsteps fading away into the tunnel behind him. And so David returns to the clutches of the police. DCI Redmond joins the OCU. Damo is safe in the underground. And Lydia is still at large to bite David on the arse. Part two of our story is nearing its conclusion, listeners. So join me next time for episode 30 of Underwood and Flinch Underground. The music you're listening to is Ahmad Armor by Farid Farjad. You can buy the track online at Amazon, iTunes, or you can stream it from Spotify. Whatever that is, people tell me it's good, but I like to stick with my gramophone records. And so, there we are, listeners, Underwood and Flinch Underground, episode 29. I hope you enjoyed it. I'll be back again in your ears soon. But from me for now, until the moon rises again over Patreon, farewell. And if you're still here, thank you very, very much for supporting me here on Patreon. The next podcast will be an episode of Dracula. Until then, pip pip and cheerio.